guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. As usual, this is the technical net. Starts every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. Usually lasts 4 hours. Means we stop at midnight. And it's a gathering of the clan where guys come together to teach each other ham radio and ways of making it better. Okay, gotta find out where my voice is coming out of somewhere else in the system. The main purpose of the technical net, as I mentioned, is education. And there's an awful lot to be learned about wireless equipment, transmitters, receivers, transmission lines, antennas. How does all this work? Propagation. And there's 26 or more kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. This extremely educational hobby, if for some reason it doesn't please you, before you give up on it, try one of the other 27 kinds, is my recommendation. Let me drop. We have a kind of a loose schedule that we follow for the last 33 years. This is going to be technet number 1584 of the series that began September of 1982, 33 years and 2 months ago. The very loose schedule that we've slowly developed, which is subject to modification if you have strong enough feelings, is that for the first hour we take general sign-ins and questions from people who do have a question or a comment, and we discuss those subjects. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag. He also monitors the EchoLink website. So if we're a little bit too quick on the key and you don't get a chance to sign in by EchoLink, John will know about it. He brings it to our attention, and that gets corrected. Let me drop. I see what's going on. And where my voice is coming out of. The other thing that we know about is that after John goes through the mailbag questions, 2, 3, or 4 of those, depending on how good are the questions, how much enthusiasm there is for that. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who is our space expert, and tells us the latest that has been going on with National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And the tradition is I almost always ask him, how is Voyager doing? Voyager, as you know, is the most far-ranging piece of electronics or space hardware that mankind has ever created. It's out there something like 12 billion miles, 3 times the distance to Pluto. And you could call it a QRP transmitter. So from 12 billion miles away, the 6-watt transmitter is continuously talking to us. And NASA has reason to believe it's going to be doing that until the year 2024 or something like that. And how it does that is really something interesting. And the signal strength that we get from that is just out of sight. We'll discuss that sometime later. Along the way, from time to time, let me drop. Cal has a lot of experience with a lot of electronics, K6 DPZ. And so he believes that most of the time he can give a more brief answer than I do. And sometimes that's true. And sometimes you get both the brief answer and the long answer simultaneously. One of the things that we've often asked people in the past, that when we're answering your question, do you think we should be giving brief answers or the more extensive answers? Can we ask that question? When we finally talk to people in a venue where they can give us their true opinion, the answer almost always is, please give the more brief question, the more brief answers. But when you get to my question, please give me the long answer. I want all the information. You can sort of see what's going on here. So we try to hit some kind of a happy medium. And we're open to your suggestions. There are a couple of websites that are connected to the TechNet. Let me drop it. Those websites, I call them Mike Number 1 and Mike Number 2. Mike Perry, KC2NJI, is Mike Number 1. His website is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. What's unique about that website is Mike has put forth a heroic amount of effort for the last 10 years just on this net alone. You go to the website and the last 10 years of the TechNet, with very few exceptions, are recorded. So you choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and it comes in 1-hour reels and you can play it back. So people who are not able to keep their eyes open for the 4 hours until midnight because they got to go to work the next day. A few days after each TechNet, like Wednesday or Thursday, the most recent TechNet appears on that website, and you can download it to your recording material, whatever that is, and therefore you can listen to the TechNet while driving to work, while sitting on the train, or on your lunch hour, and so on, because you're not able to stay up late enough. And for those who, let me drop. For those who don't yet have their ham radio license or the right equipment so they can talk to us directly, by sending an email to John, KC2WGB, and he'll be telling you his exact email address a little bit later. That's the way that you, that's the way you get your request onto the priority list, so to speak, of the mailbag, and therefore we can approach your question even though we can't talk to you directly. The majority of what the TechNet is a live give and take response to people's questions. John and I are not suggesting that we're going to supply by letters or internet or whatever. We're not going to supply a free consulting service, a written free consulting service. We are willing to do this, if you know what I mean, verbally, because it speeds up things tremendously. When somebody writes you a question, quite often he uses the wrong words, really asks the wrong question, the wrong question gets answered, and a whole lot of emails have to flow back and forth before you finally get on the right subject. When you're speaking to the guy real time, live, you find that out in 20 seconds, and things flow a lot faster. Also, I can talk 150 words a minute, but I type about 10 words a minute, if you know what I mean. So I really don't want to type answers to people. Let me drop. And the other mic I was telling you about is Mike. His website is limogtechnet.com. And on Mike number 2's website, you'll find an awful lot of good information, pictures, articles, and so on, connected to the TechNet. And I'm going to be submitting some more articles to Mike pretty soon that I've been piling up for. I realize there's a couple of missing articles that should be there. Okay, you now know the schedule. I'm about to ask you guys to sign in because you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're listening. We used to have in the very beginning long lists of people who signed in because they're listening. Well, after 33 years, that doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. We accept the fact that somebody is listening somewhere. And so please just sign in if you do have a real question or a comment. It makes things a little bit faster. So if you got a question or a comment, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, try to remember your name, and give that to me, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Each time that we pass it back to you, if you know what I mean, try to remember to wait for the 4 beeps before you start transmitting. Lots of people, let me drop. Those are the 4 beeps. Lots of people get excited because they know they're about to be approached to give their question or the rest of their question and answer and so on. And so they get real quick on the mic and don't wait for the 4 beeps, in which case the whole system doesn't get reset properly, and portions of the Echo Link, IRLP, other repeaters that are connected, they get timed out. So try to remember the 4 beeps. Now's the time to give me your call letters and name if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW in the TechNet, we're listening.
WHYYSP, John. WHYY, Joe, yes.
We got Joe, and I think there was a John that was a double. Who is the other person?
This is K2IXP. November 2, Hotel Uniform Hotel, Andy Woodhaven, Queens.
Okay, N2HUH, Andy, we got them, got you after blank 2IXP. Blank 2IXP, give me the prefix and your handle, I should know you. Go right ahead, IXP.
Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa, handle is John, Jericho, New York.
Very fine, Jericho, New York, John. So far in the order was Joe, John, and Andy. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet because you do have a question or comment? address and name right now after the four beeps.
Voltages
than the Schottky diode. I think Dustin can give you some kind of a response at around 0.1 volt or maybe even less. Some of these really super good RFID tags can respond to a signal as weak as minus 20 dBm at the tag, which is what? 1/100th of a milliwatt. That's 10 microwatts. 10 microwatts of power delivered to the diode, to the dipole that's on a RFID tag, in some cases will make it give you full response and maybe out to 20 to 24 foot of range. So there they've worked on, again, very fancy rectifiers. So in your case, full-wave rectifier or half-wave rectifier, it's not really a variable because you don't care about hum. You're trying to get, if you're trying to get the maximum sensitivity, you want the lowest possible conducting voltage of the rectifier. And maybe there's a field effect transistor thing, which is slightly better than the Schottky diodes, is the right way to go. Bunch of opinions, but now you see what those opinions are based on, Joe. W2RYY, good question. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, the reason I named both is because I was really interested more in accuracy, not sensitivity. I realize you can only go so low as far as applying a voltage onto that diode. Below a certain RF voltage, and you won't be able to read it accurately with a, you know, like something with a high impedance digital VOM. I was looking more for accuracy. So if you say a half wave or a full wave, really, I mean, half wave or a bridge, it really doesn't matter, except for the voltage drop across the should be different in each. I guess I can do the same. I can do it, use it either way, and just to subtract the right voltage that drop across the diode, and then I can come up with an accurate answer.
If you really wanted to do this as a science experiment, and if you did enough research, for a particular Schottky diode that has a particular doping profile across its chip, where there is a predictable amount of current for each amount of voltage applied to it as a rectifier, you could therefore, with high accuracy, predict the accuracy of the RF detector, which is really a power indicator. However, what you're really going to do, Joe, once you set up your circuit, you're going to start off with a calibrated signal generator, maybe double checking it with a power meter, and now you're going to put various amounts of power into your diode rectifying circuit. You're therefore going to see what DC voltage you get out of it into your digital voltmeter, and therefore the conversion of voltage indicated versus RF power input in watts, microwatts, dBm, whatever units. That conversion, that calibration procedure is where your accuracy is going to come from. Whether or not you're using a full-wave rectifier or a half-wave rectifier or a bridge rectifier, you may get a slightly different power input versus voltage output curve. But in all cases, you're going to be calibrating it, Joe. So the accuracy of the circuit, your calibration procedure, makes that a washout, if you know what I mean. So for what I think you're trying to do, you want the most sensitive circuit, and therefore Schottky's and or this field effect rectifier circuit that's now being talked about, that's being used by the world's best RFID tags. The actual little chip, let me grab it. That little black integrated circuit chip, which is about 1/32 or 1/64 of an inch square. You have to look at it with a microscope. That little black dot that's in the middle of the diode, of the dipole of an RFID tag, it's doing all of that, rectifying and modulating and sending you back a 96-bit code. That's a really tiny thing that's very busy and very, very efficient. And so you possibly want to copy some of those circuits, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'll say again, I was looking for more accuracy than sensitivity, because if you don't have a power meter, you don't really have a way of calibrating the input power you're putting in the thing to know whether you're reading something right or not. That was the whole idea, or something like this, to make a simple way of determining power for the 50 ohm dummy load if you're, you know, you set it up that way. If you can read that RF voltage and calculate it back enough, divide it by R and come up with a power answer. sir, and be fairly certain that the accuracy is going to be within a very small percentage of reality.
Yeah, as I see it, to repeat what I said, Joe, which is a little bit left of center what you're saying, your calibration procedure is where your accuracy is going to come from. But I know you didn't say it to me, and it was in your mind, and you didn't tell me. What you're really trying to do is create a circuit that other people can duplicate, and therefore they have a predictable amount of response. Therefore, they don't need calibration. That's what I think you're now seeking. You're trying to make a schematic diagram that you can publish that other people can create. When it comes to the higher voltages that you apply to a circuit like this, in other words, the actual peak voltage you're going to get out of a half-wave rectifier, when you're putting, let me think what that number was, I think you get something like 10 volts of rectification when you're feeding it, I think it's either 1 watt or is it a tenth of a watt. Anyhow, I had gone through this procedure. Turns out that the diode itself doing the rectification, when you're down at the very low portion of the diode's curve, it's keyed to a square law response. The voltage output versus the power input follows the square law. And that's up to approximately minus 20 dBm into almost every diode. As you get beyond minus 20 dBm, minus 10 and 0 dBm on the way up, it now is a linear voltage response. The peak RF voltage gives you the response of the diode, but that the toe of its curve is where it's got the square law characteristic where ordinarily calibration is required. On top of that, Joe, when you try to publish a schematic diagram that other people can create and that recreate and therefore, let me drop it, and therefore have a predictable response within the accuracy requirement that you're speaking of. What's really going on there, Joe, is that you can have the best schematic in the world. Each individual guy is going to lay it out differently. Unless you're supplying the schematic, unless you're supplying the printed circuit board, the way he lays out the actual 50-ohm resistor that's acting like the dummy load, and the way the way he dresses the wiring, and the way he lays out the rectifier Schottky diode and so on, and the bypassing capacitor, and then the series coupling resistor to the output, the way he lays that out is going to make a significant amount of difference between serial number one built by ham radio operator number one versus the one built by ham radio operator number two. His difference in layout is going to give you a problem where if you're looking for 1% accuracy without calibration, it's going to be very, very difficult to get. So I think you're going to have to fall back on calibration unless you are willing to build a whole lot of these circuits with various mechanical configurations, anticipating all the different ways that your various ham radio friends can actually build this thing. And therefore, you'll get a distribution of accuracies, if you know what I mean. And you can then build enough of these things in order to tell him where the center of the Gaussian curve is. So I built these kind of power detectors. And in my particular case, 5 or 10% accuracy was good enough for what I was doing. I sense you're looking for more accuracy than that, Joe. And it's going to be a bit of a challenge. W2RYY, K2RYW in the tech man.
Well, I have a generator that's capable of generating up to plus 20 dBm as far as just to be able to check something like this out. And of course, I can put a transmitter in, but the transmitter, you don't know what the power is unless you can measure it accurately with some sort of device. So you're assuming that one has an accurate power meter, and if they don't, this is why I'm asking this kind of question, to be able to build something to be able to rectify voltage across, say, a 50-ohm load and come up with a reasonably accurate answer of what the actual wattage is actually being applied to that load.
Another suggestion I've got here, Joe, is that if you carefully choose a series resistor that's in series with a Schottky diode, although it's going to hurt your efficiency, your sensitivity a little bit at the low end, give you a huge amount of protection on the high end. This is a Schottky rectifier. The good news about a Schottky diode is that it only takes something like 0.2 volts to make it go significantly into its conduction curve. The bad news is the Schottky diode doesn't have a very large peak inverse voltage. So as you start putting a significant amount of power into the circuit, the back voltage on the Schottky diode, which sends it into a Zener breakdown where it starts dissipating power, it can blow out the Schottky, and you can therefore give it quite a bit of protection by way of a series resistor that will protect it from that circuit to a certain amount, probably the next 10 or 15 to 20 dB of signal strength. It will be protected by the series resistor. And to go one step beyond that, you might actually consider putting in a clipping diode circuit that beyond a certain power level limits the amount of voltage that can go into your Schottky diode. But I see what you're seeking, and if we Google those the right words, I think you're going to find circuits that people have built, and you didn't say what accuracy you're looking for. If you wanted 5 or 10% accuracy, pretty easy to do. If you want 1% accuracy, that's difficult. And when it comes to calibrating it, if the guy has access to a calibrated signal generator, a bird watt meter, a vector voltage meter, and so on, yes, an awful lot of your friends, let me drop a quick. An awful lot of your friends might not have that piece of instrumentation required for calibrating. But unless the guy lives in Podunk, in the backwoods somewhere, most of the hams you and I have access to have a local ham radio club. For instance, the Rochester Amateur Radio Association has over 500 members. LIMOC has over 400 members, and so on. There's usually a local club, and there are members of that club that are very well instrumented. And so, by way of your membership or even temporary membership in that club and borrowing the piece of test equipment or bringing your circuit over to the guy who's got the test equipment, there are ways of calibrating. So I do recommend calibration as the easiest way to get the accuracy I think you're looking for. And in the modern day, because instrumentation is getting quite a bit cheaper, and by way of good clubs, it's quite accessible, that's a good way to go. To try to get a couple of percent accuracy by just following a schematic diagram and using the right parts, that's a tough requirement as I see it, Joe. W2LYY, K2LYW in the second half.
Okay, very good. Well, question was just a thought as far as trying to put some of these together. Was it something I was going to write as a paper on, or schematic of a ham or something else? And most people on the hams I know are test equipment orientated as I am, but I do know. So, okay, thanks.
Very fine, Joe. And
hey, Dick.
I check in with us periodically and let us know how that project is going. Go ahead, John.
Do me a favor, add me to the list of questions, because I have a question I'd like your opinion on when you get a chance.
Okay, who was that? Who was that masked man? That's John, KC2WGB. Better write it down, otherwise I'm going to forget him again. Alrighty. John is next. John number one. Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa from Jericho. Go right ahead, John, K2LIW.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, John. All the best people are named John. I have two very simple questions. I'm relatively new at working with amateur radio equipment, and I'm using Belden 9913 wire on a Diamond V2000 Alpha monopole multiband antenna. When I peel the Belden, and I have no experience with the Belden, there's a silver paper-like material between the outer insulation and the inner dielectric. Is that insulation, or is that part of, like, the coil?
When it comes to low-loss RG8-like coaxial cable, 50-ohm coax cable, 9913, because it's primarily an air dielectric with a spiral in there of plastic material that holds the center conductor in the right place, 9913 became very famous, very fast, 15 or so years ago, maybe 20 years ago, because it's low in loss. However, within a couple of years, it develops a very poor reputation because with that great big airspace inside, and because air is a beautiful power piston, and we don't realize it. On a super hot summer day with the sun beating down on your cable outdoors and it's beating down on that black outer jacket, the cable can get up to some pretty high temperatures. Air, when it's at a high temperature, expands. Along comes a rain cloud, and suddenly a whole bunch of cold rain gets doused onto your outer cable, and the air inside gets cooled off, compresses, and sucks in the water. So 9913 had a whole lot of problems with water getting into the cable. Therefore, the modern-day version of it has another dash number, which I don't know about. Maybe it's 9913A1 or something like that. Now has this inner foil. It's really a... I think it's a plastic material with a silvering to it. But that inner layer of material you're talking about is weatherproofing. And so when you properly install the connector on the end of that cable, that inner layer is giving you a hell of a lot of waterproofing because... Let me drop.
Dick, that's usually aluminized mylar.
Okay, so the aluminized mylar inner layer that you're talking about there, John, is there primarily for waterproofing. The real outer braid is giving you most of the outer conductor, RF conduction, so to speak. But that aluminized mylar is there for waterproofing to try to stop water ingression because the outer black polyethylene jacket looks like a beautiful weather seal. It's a moderately good weather seal, but it is not a hermetic seal. That's a fancy way of saying that water vapor will slowly breathe through that outer polyethylene jacket into your cable if that inner layer of material that you're talking about wasn't there. So got to be a little bit careful with the way you install the connectors on the end to make sure you keep the integrity of that waterproofing, and if you're doing a real good job after the connector has been connected to the antenna, you then will wrap it with some other kind of material, like various kinds of tape and tar and whatever, in order to keep the water from ingressing at the connector itself. So water is the most lossy material in the world when it comes to RF energy, John. You got to keep the water out of your cable. A few drops of water in the middle of a piece of 9913 can easily give you 10 or 15 dB of loss just for the couple of inches of cable that has that little bit of water in it, if you know what I mean. Water is a beautiful dummy load. You got to keep it out of your cables. KD2IXP, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, John.
So inside that silvery-looking mylar, like paper, that's where the actual core is, the actual braided core.
And you've probably seen 9913 more recently than I have, John. Is that the silverized mylar, is that on the inside of the braid or the outside of the braid? It almost doesn't matter. In either case, it's giving you the weatherproofing. But just to make sure we're talking about the same material, where is that actual aluminized mylar located? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Usually on the inside of the foil, the ones I've seen, I've only seen the ones on the inside of the foil. You know, besides temperature change, Dick, don't forget barometric pressure change also causes a pumping action, which is going on all of the time. So, yeah, it migrates easily.
Okay, you said it's inside of the foil. Okay, that's ambiguous. I'm trying to find out, is the aluminized mylar inside of the braid or outside of the braid? Over to you, John.
It's on the inside of the braid.
Fantastic. Okay. So its primary purpose is weatherproofing. The braid itself gives you the majority of the strength and in most cases the majority of the RF conduction. Whether or not the aluminized mylar is also doing a substantial amount of the RF conduction of the outer conductor, there I'm not sure. The possibility exists that the aluminized mylar is a beautiful weatherproofing material, but it might not be RF conductive, so to speak. It may be silver. looking, but it might have a skin depth that's too thin where the real RF is being conducted by the outer braid. I'm not sure about that, but there's ways of finding out. But that's those are minor academic details. As long as you keep the water out of that 9913 and you've got the connectors properly installed, you'll be very happy with its insertion loss. And for its diameter, it's got one of the very lowest insertion losses that you can buy. KD2IXP, K2IW in the TechNet.
Oh, thank you for that one. The other one is very simple, and I have already gotten an answer from John from Staten Island. And I appreciate it. I'm just looking for different opinions. I have a television aerial, an antenna on my roof. I'm an old-fashioned guy, and I refuse to pay for 160 channels of television when I can get it for free. The TV antenna is up. It's properly aimed. The azimuth is correct. And I'm getting good channel reception on all the televisions in the house that antenna is connected to. On the old one, which I had, which I lost during Hurricane Sandy, I had an RF VHF, UHF, FM amplifier. It was powered by 110 volts, and it went in line with the cable that came down, the antenna cable. It appears that antenna amplifier has gone to the Great Antenna Amplifier Graveyard, and I'm looking to purchase a new one. Now, I've gotten some excellent suggestions, and I was just wondering if any of the gentlemen who work in television, or maybe Dick, or someone, I've spoken to John about it and gotten some excellent assistance from him, but I was wondering if anybody else had any comments on replacing that amplifier, getting a new amplifier.
WS2N.
Yeah, there's about three guys that I know that can really give you good advice on choosing a good low-noise preamplifier for over-the-air digital television reception. One of those is Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. He did quite a bit of research on that, and he's doing quite a bit of digital television DXing. Another one, of course, is Eric, K-E-2-E-J, who for the last zillion years has worked in the broadcast industry. And the other one is Paul, W-S-2-N, who also did quite a bit of research on digital preamplifiers to be added to the antenna. Since Paul is here right now, tell him, Paul, what is your recommended brand name, where do you buy it, and roughly how many dollars does it cost? How long have you been using it? How happy are you with it? WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I like the one there. Philips, they're a little hard to get now. You used to be able to get them in the store. And that was, they claimed 18 dB. And then the other ones were from Radio Shack. And I believe that was an RCA. And that was, they said it was 12 dB. But both of them worked equally. I couldn't find the difference between either one. And for instance, the Philips I've had plugged in for quite a few years now. And I just never unplug it. It just stays there. There's no switch or anything. It just stays plugged in. And it's doing what you're doing. It's running all the antennas. That one antenna is piped into like three different locations. So plus I'm able to record off the antenna and everything. It's great. I can say I've got a DVD recorder in line. But it's the same type you're talking about. You just plug it in down near the set, and you don't have to be up on. You don't have to have cut it in on near the antenna or anything. And without it, you're dead in the water. It's so many more stations. And money wise, it was probably, I don't know, $18 or something. It was inexpensive. One I got from Walmart. The other one I got from Radio Shack. And that was when
get it. And hopefully Walmart and or I think Home Depot also sells these things in a bubble pack. And it might be the Philips model. I'm not quite sure. Joe, if you're with us, what's your favorite brand? Somehow I think it's not going to be Philips. Your favorite brand, how many dB of gain, how many dollars, and where do you buy it? K2RYY. I hope you're still with us, Joe. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Oh, I'm here. I'm still listening. I have a wine garden antenna. And with that, I use the companion mass-mounted preamp. You don't have to, you know, run that preamp on the mass of the antenna. You could run it inside the house if you choose to do so, but it's made mapped on the at the top of the antenna. I think the gain of mine is an 80, well, let me put it this way. The original one I bought, which is an AT8275, was about $39 from Weingarten. They don't make that model anymore. It had about 17 to 18 dB of gain, maybe a little higher on the lower frequencies. Works low band, high band, and UHF. They're making a replacement for that now called an LNA200. It has, I think, 20 dB on low band and maybe about 16 to 18 dB on VHF and UHF, but it has a lower noise here and it has a much higher susceptibility rate as far as interference by a strong local carrier. Like something out of band or whatever coming into the preamp itself. It has a much higher, well, I guess the proper terms of overload factor. Those are available, actually funny place you can get them from. Home Depot carries them. I think you can order them online through Home Depot. They're about $40. I've never tried one. I don't know how well they work, but it's supposed to be a replacement for the 8275P, which is what I'm currently running right now. But you do, it is good to have a preamp, a decent preamp on the thing, because the digital TV reception below a certain threshold level, you're just not going to get it. It's not like the old days with VHF, UHF analog TV. You could somehow see a picture. Digital TV is either there or it's pretty much not.
To you with a comment on Joe's original first question, Dick.
Mobile with a question about the 9913 also.
Okay, so, Mike, Professor Cosma, go right ahead with your information. WY2U, K2RW in the TechNet.
Oh, hi, Dick, and all on the net. I'm not involved in this conversation per se, but this involves, I wasn't able to come to the radio before when Joe was asking his question about the RF detection scheme. So my comment is about that. If you want to let me in after this discussion, I've got a couple of things to add to that if you want there, Dick. Go ahead.
And Dick, I have the model number for the Radio Shack unit if he wants to have it right here in my hand.
Okay, so we're going to come back to you in a couple of minutes, Mike. So we'll complete with this particular question of John. Paul, go right ahead with your model number, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, you find a Radio Shack that's open, maybe they still have it. But it's the Radio Shack bi-directional cable TV amplifier, and their model, you know, the number that you would put in for the computer is 150-2505. 150-2505. And, you know, that'll come right up on this computer.
Sounds to me like Walmart has got, or Radio Shack, whichever, Walmart has got multiple brands. Where Joe has investigated the one by Weingarten, which has got a darn good reputation, and the so-called LNA-200 is known to have a high intercept point. If they're advertising how high the intercept point is, the so-called overload characteristics, there is a possibility that where you live there in Jericho, John, it would be nice to know that you've got one that's not too easy to overload because of a local taxi cab or oil delivery service or whatever. So I wonder if you need any fills on any of what you've heard so far, John. And before I go back to you, John, there was another person who wanted to give us some information on this subject. Who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet.
No audio there, Dick.
Yeah, I could tell. All right, so let's see if John needs any fills on anything we've heard so far. KD2IXP, K2IW in TechNet. You got it, John.
I just want
thank you to John and Dick and all the other gentlemen who helped me with this project. I have some choices, and I can do a little hunting and investigating. Thank you for your time, gentlemen. It is much appreciated. 82 IXP, and I'll be on the side listening.
John, when you do buy an amplifier and install it, and if it works well or it doesn't work well, either case, please come back and let us know. Give us some feedback. So now we're going to go back to Joe's, the first question of John on the subject of 9913. Looks like Mike has been using that material. WY2U, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mike.
I guess we got no beep or somebody's holding the carrier down. No, I was talking about the question about the diode detection scheme. I think that was Joe who was asking it there, Dick, if I'm not mistaken. Go ahead.
Yes, it was Joe, and please give us that information, Mike.
Okay, no beep. My first comment, well, I got to ask a question first of Joe, if I can jump in there. Joe, is it absolutely your requirement that you must use a peak envelope detector or diode detector in this application? Is that affirmative?
Well, I'm not looking for a peak envelope detector. I'm basically looking for something to simply tell you if your instrumentation that you're using is working correctly. Like, for example, if you had this detector going into a 50 ohm load, and it'd be either, you know, before or after a bird watt meter in series with it, to be able to give you an indication if you want me to reading fairly correctly, because, you know, this is a simple formula, you know, E squared by R equals power. And you might want to be able to take that RF voltage and, you know, process it properly to be able to get it, probably come up with a decent answer as to the calibration of your instrument that you're looking at when you're, you know, observing wattage being applied to it. That was the basis of the question. And I didn't know whether to use a simple half-wave rectification process from the RF point going into the dummy load, being applied to the dummy load, or using a bridge rectifier. And Dick says apparently at that frequency range going to RF, it doesn't seem to make a difference. Back to you.
Okay, with the beeps back. I understand. I gather you're using something just to detect a pure unmodulated carrier, it sounds like, anyway, because I thought maybe you wanted something a little bit more affluent than that, that would not only measure carrier average power, which I think is what you're saying, but also would have the ability to talk and to respond to peak to average ratio, peak envelope power, and that type of thing. Because I was going to offer up a solution that I used when I was working at MPD. It's a chip made by Hittite. I got the part number right here. It's an HMC614. It's got about 70 dB dynamic range, DC coupled, believe it or not. And it's an entire RMS detector. Actually, there's two RMS detectors in a chip, one for peak envelope detection and one for average, with two separate outputs, which you can either look at separately or figure out some way to convolve into an integrated circuit to give you an indication of what the average and peak envelope power is. As I recall, they used to be about $18. And this one's good from about DC to 3.9 gigahertz. Not a peak envelope detector, not a diode detector like you're talking about there, Joe, but it's a lot more versatile than that. And basically, it's a whole RF measuring system on a chip. Without calibrating the way Dick was describing before, this chip alone has about plus or minus 1 dB of accuracy. But if you wanted to spend the time of putting in certain frequencies at known power levels, I gather you can achieve a lot better than that. So if you are interested in perhaps obtaining a integrated circuit solution, I'd recommend the Hittite. Again, it's an HMC, Hotel Mike Charlie 614, and I believe it's about $18 retail. I think DigiKey sells them. Dick, over to you. This is WY to you.
I have a question of the particular chip you talked about, and that is, how much power can you apply this to this chip, and do you have to do anything as far as using a voltage divider to limit the amount of RF voltage or voltage being applied to this chip?
My similar question, Mike, is where do you believe the threshold is? Would it be able to read a minus 20 dBm signal, so to speak? So Joe wants to know how much power will blow it out. I want to know how much power it takes to start responding, if you happen to know. You got it, Mike. WY2U, K2RIW, and TechNet. You got to sign in more often, Mike.
Oh, no, it's a whole logarithmic optic receiver. It's a broadband log receiver in a chip. It responds down to about minus 60 dBm. Minus 60 dBm to plus 10, I think burnout's about plus 15. So whatever power level you have, you have to make sure that the crest never exceeds plus 15 dBm. Go ahead, Dick.
Wow, that's a lot of dynamic range. That's way beyond what you can get with a Schottky diode detector. The Schottky diode on a good day might get you down to minus 15, minus 18. This thing goes down to minus 60, up to plus 10, and it's got logarithmic detection all the way. Oh boy, could you have a lot of fun with that. You might have some questions on this one, Joe. I have worked for 10 solid years with logarithmic IF detectors by way of the design of AIL spectrum analyzers. It was a quasi homebrew. By that I mean it was an AIL designed logarithmic amplifier using Plessy logarithmic chips, and it had 100 dB of dynamic range. I vaguely remember it went all the way down to like minus 80 dBm, up to plus 15 or plus 20. So you might have some further questions on whether or not you'd be happy with logarithmic response of input versus output. To B2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
I think you need to repeat it. I mean, I heard your carrier hung up here on the one of the links, so your east one dropping them if it came back or not. But anyway, I would look for something that handled much more power. I'm interested in basically a CW carrier. I don't care if it's detecting sideband or AM modulation. It's just simply for pure checking the accuracy of another, you know, watt meter or wattage indicating device. I didn't initially need something to go very low, like to, you know, minus 60 below zero or something like that. That's pretty low. That's good for testing, checking test equipment. But then again, also the question would be, how do you calibrate that? Well, you need a power sensor head to be able to calibrate that, or some sort of very active spectrum analyzer to be able to set that initially to get the calibration to work correctly. Back to you.
I'm going to be passing it back to Joe for a confirmation. If I understand what Joe just told us, this Hittite HMC614 has a known throughput characteristic. It is claiming that as long as you know what power you're putting into it, the logarithmic video voltage you're going to get out of this will have plus or minus 1 dB of accuracy, and that's probably before you calibrate it. So it starts off with known accuracy right at the chip level, if you know what I mean. And the fact that it's got that kind of dynamic range, minus 60 to plus 10, 70 decibels of dynamic range. If you're worried about blowing it out because you're testing 5-watt and 50-watt transmitters, it's easy for you to take a sampling port by way of a BNC connector or many other ways, directional coupler. You can sample some of the energy going into your high-power 50-ohm dummy load, and that what actually goes to the Hittite would be isolated by, let's say, a 40 decibel pad. So because it goes down to minus 60 dBm, any RF power you're measuring, you do it by way of a 40 dB attenuator into the Hittite. Your input coaxial cable goes directly to the dummy load, but you take a sample of that 40 dB down, and now because of that large dynamic range, most of the time you're not below threshold, but now you can tolerate a whole lot of watts of power without blowing out the Hittite. Let's see if Mike thinks I'm even close on some of these assumptions here. WY2U, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Mike.
Yes, sir. You're 100% right on. As a matter of fact, that exactly was the application. We were using these chips in a cellular base station, which put out about 50 watts of RF power at, what the heck frequency, 1900 megahertz or thereabouts in that band. And we had a 60 dB directional coupler in line, and we were sampling the 60 dB down port into this system, and we were able then to predict what the peak average ratio was of the carrier itself based on how many carriers were in line online at the time, and also get a measure of what the capability of the amplifier was for total average power, because this chip did have the capability to actually display both. And again, the accuracy without doing any offline calibration, they claim, is plus or minus 1 dB. As I recall, we measured a lot better than that. But if Joe wanted to actually get in there and measure on a per frequency basis and calibrate it beforehand, he can probably achieve a couple of percent accuracy with no problem at all. But what you described, Dick, is exactly the application that we used the chip in, and it worked very well in that application. Back to the net, WI2U.
And I've done a couple of back-of-the-envelope quick calculations here. Because Mike was using it with a 60 dB directional coupler, that means if he put in a kilowatt signal, which is plus 60 dBm, because it's a 60 dB directional coupler, he would only be getting 0 dBm out of the coupler. And the spectrum, and his hitch height can go 10 dB higher than that. So in other words, the way he was using it, he could tolerate peak envelope power of plus 70 dBm, which is 10 kilowatts. So he's good for 10 kilowatts on the high end because of the 60 dB attenuator and minus 60 dB of sensitivity of the Hittite. He was therefore good for, if I understand correctly, 0 dBm. So 1 milliwatt going into the directional coupler, all the way up to 10 kilowatts into the directional coupler. All of that went into the dummy load by way of the coupler's coupled port into the Hittite. He was reading that power all the way from 1 milliwatt up to 10 kilowatts. Did I get the mathematics on that one correct, Mike? WY2U, KQLIW in the TechNet. Beautiful setup.
Yes, sir. Your dBs are correct, although we never had to go up to a kilowatt in this application. The highest power level, peak envelope power, crest factor included, was plus 47 dBm. So minus 13 was the highest, I guess that's about right. Yeah, minus 13 was the highest power level that we were seeing into this chip. And then, you know, we had the ability, if we needed to go down 60 dB from there, although we never had that need. It only had to go down about 35 dB from there. Our specification at the time was for a 40 dB measurement capability at peak envelope power on down. But yes, what you're saying is 100% correct. If you have a high power 60 dB directional coupler, in theory you can measure accurately up to 10 kW. Go ahead.
Fantastic. Did that Hittite also include, for its sampled power, was it also a 50 dB termination? Or did you have to supply the termination at the front end of the Hittite? Over to you, Mike.
Oh boy, I'm going back 15 years. As I recall, the application note states that you have to place your own 50 ohm resistor at the input terminals of the chip. So you need a high precision 50 ohm resistor to ground to terminate the input of the amplifier. Go ahead.
That's still a lot of electronics for the money. Boy, a logarithmic detector properly used can give you some beautiful dynamic range. I mean, if you used a crystal detector straight into an oscilloscope and you try to measure RF power, you're hard-pressed to get 15 dB of dynamic range on that screen. You know, from the weakest signal that just barely moves the trace at the bottom of the screen all the way up to the top, 15 dB is probably the best dynamic range you can get out of a crystal detector. By way of logarithmic detection, this Hittite gives you 70 dB. By way of the, I could show you how to use a pair of Hittites to get more than 100 dB. That's essentially what we were doing on the spectrum analyzer. So there's a lot to be said for that method of approach. And then that video output, you could listen to that video output as audio, measure peaks and averages and whatever. I will warn you though, a logarithmic output on amplitude modulation has a peculiar kind of distortion, but there's a way you can put an anti-logging video circuit, a very simple op-amp video circuit, so that now you would get clean audio out of this thing, if that's what you wanted to do, to monitor an AM broadcast station. FM broadcast, FM stations, of course, that ain't gonna work. You see where I'm going on this one, Joe? W2RYY for any other comments, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Well, it's another interesting idea to a problem I'm sure other people have probably thought about. How do I check the calibration of my test equipment or power monitoring device to see if it's within itself is accurate? So, okay, back to net.
While I've got you guys here, and this is something you probably know about, Mike, I know that the Mini Circuits company has been making a whole series of computer-savvy power meters.